Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 and goes out every Thursday morning at 11am here on BCFM 93.2. This week, investigating David Icke. Hot or not? Doo-doo or guru? Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square. And we'll have a reminder of the phone number and website for Volunteering Bristol at the end of the show. And we start this week with Jason Yannakopoulos. Hi, Jason. Welcome to Dialect.
Hello, Tony.
Now, we're going to have a little look at some of the news this week, starting with Scottish independence. And why have you brought that up?
Well, on Tuesday, the Scottish government brought out their blueprint for a Scottish independent state, which is quite interesting. They came up with numerous ideas that some critics have suggested aren't viable without massive raises in tax.
Okay, so what's the crux of it? I know one of the things most controversially is that they look like they will be getting rid of Trident completely and getting rid of nuclear weapons from around the Scottish coast. I suppose that puts Britain in a bit of a fix, having just said that they're going to be closing down their facilities in Portsmouth to deal with the nuclear. So most likely we're going to have all these nuclear submarines chugging around the world with no home port to come back to.
Oh yes, that is a major problem, and it's been a massive gamble. Of course, it's dependent on the results of the Scottish vote next year whether or not that gamble will pay off.
Okay, so whereabouts does this all come from? Because I mean, I don't get the idea that this is something which is sort of welled up within the British parliamentary system as a massive sort of, you know, parliamentarians being overcome by democracy and saying, oh, we must give the people a say. Isn't this just a regionalisation agenda being foisted on us by the European Union? They're saying things like, well, Wales can be a separate EU region and Scotland an EU region, and we'll give them their own parliaments.
Well, the idea is actually a new Labour idea of 1997. One of their big ideas was to create regional parliaments. I mean, in a sense, I think what they maybe wanted, I'm not sure, was sort of similar to what Germany has with 16 different states.
Oh, like in Switzerland, for example, with the cantons. Yeah. But this has come from the EU. It's not just come from ordinary Scottish people or the Labour Party.
No.
I mean, it's surely, you know, it's just a bit of top-down reorganisation under the guise of, you know, we're renewing democracy. We've got this crazy situation at the moment where we've got the Scottish Parliament, we've got a Welsh Parliament, but no English Parliament.
The West Lothian question, indeed.
Oh yeah, we mentioned this last week briefly, didn't we? And this is a question of whether Scottish MPs should be voting on English issues.
Yeah.
Okay, so how's this vote going to go, do you think? I mean, we keep hearing about Alex Salmond, the SNP.
Alex Salmond, I mean, they've come up with some great ideas, such as vulnerable two-year-olds, three-year-olds and four-year-olds getting as much care as possible. Which sounds great. The only question is how they're going to fund it.
Well, another question is what is happening with parents? Because, you know, can't parents look after children? I mean, this is what most parents want, is they want to have more time to spend with their own children.
Yeah.
The government are offering them a sop, aren't they? They're saying, you can... I tell you what, we will pay to look after your children. We won't pay for you to have more time with your children. We want them.
Yeah, that is quite scary. And to a degree, it's really bad that they're not affording parents more time to spend their children. In fact, one of the really worrying things here, they say they're going to keep the sterling and they're going to keep the Bank of England as a last-minute agenda. So even if they do declare independence, they're still sort of hanging off the UK a bit.
Okay, will they still use pounds? I mean, I know they've got their own
they
pounds.
They have said they will continue to use pound sterling.
And they've got the Royal Bank of Scotland, haven't they, that issue money up there yes, hang on, that's a whole other question, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
Oh, dear. The Royal Bank of Scotland closing down companies. You know, once I actually submitted a subject access request, it's called, to MI5, asking them if I could see the data they were holding on me under the Data Protection Act.
How'd that one go, Tony?
It didn't go very well. They said, oh, no, it's secret. You're not allowed to see it. And I got a cheque back. Funny, because I had to pay, I think it was £10, for a subject access request, it's called. Anyone can do this with any organisation under the Data Protection Act that holds data on you. You can send them, I think it's £10, it's supposed to be, plus a request under the Data Protection Act, and they have to then send you any information that they hold about you as an individual, which is quite good. But obviously I was asking MI5, what information do you hold about me? They said no. But they didn't send my cheque back. They cashed my cheque. Even though they weren't going to give me any information.
And RBS cashed it back.
Well, when I asked for it back, when I asked for the money back, they sent me back a cheque from the Royal Bank of Scotland in the account of MI5. Now, guess who signed it?
No idea. Do tell.
A wavy line. And it wasn't even a signature. It literally was waves of the sea going up and down and up and down, and there wasn't even a proper signature. It's all very creepy and weird. This is the same Royal Bank of Scotland, so-called wonderful bank that we've now nationalised, but we've got no control over. And I wonder what on earth is going on with socialism in this country, where it seems to be only the sort of authoritarian type of socialism that's being offered to us these days, what with the nationalised banks being authoritarian.
It's very strange. And you asked me which way I think the vote will go. To be honest, I think they'll vote to keep the union, because the deal is, the deal that they were given by David Cameron, the deal that Alex Salmond and David Cameron negotiated, actually, if they go for independence, the UK, what's left of it, will completely screw them over.
Really? Why is that?
Well, because they have to take their share of the national debt. They we also have the issue of we take our bit of the oil service. The fact is, a lot of the money going into the Scottish Parliament, they're really overcompensating for the North Sea oil.
This is another thing. Surely they should be getting quite a lot of North Sea oil money.
Yeah, the problem is some of that goes to the UK.
And what will happen? No, but hang on. You mustn't use the word UK anymore. If Scotland becomes independent, it's no longer the UK, is it?
It is still the UK at the moment, and it'll be a different country back then. That will still come back to what's left of the UK.
Would it be? Oh, so the UK would
be
Northern
UK,
Ireland,
England, Wales, and Northern Ireland.
Oh, really? So maybe they should just call it the not so United Kingdom, as it was before. I don't know. And will they use their own flag, the Scots? The blue flag with the white cross.
They'll use the Psalter. It's whether or not they get that opportunity is another matter entirely. But
well, they went to all the trouble, didn't they, hundreds of years ago, uniting Scotland and England, now to say, no, they're nothing to do with each other. I must admit, there's a sort of independent-mindedness in Scotland. I'm not sure if I agree with you, Jason. I'm not a betting man, but I think the Scots will just simply, they respect the English, but they don't like to be shackled by Westminster, and there's very few people that do.
That's true, but
We don't even here in Bristol, do we?
No, but the thing is, if you take up the opinion polls suggest that Scotland will keep the union, even now.
Yeah, okay. On to another more local subject, Concorde. We've had the 10th anniversary of the last flight of Concorde, and there's all this talk about having a dedicated aeronautical museum. Not an aviation museum, not an aeroplane museum, not a Concorde museum, an aeronautical museum, which makes it sound sort of slightly like the Navy as well, aeronautical. But anyway, that Filton apparently is a sort of sop, I suppose, to those who are so annoyed about them selling off the airfield, and with the almost inevitable fact over the next few years of industry closing down up there, because of course it's all related to the old Filton airfield. GKN, there's a small BAE Systems office up there, as well as obviously a massive Airbus and Rolls-Royce. It makes it difficult to believe that there really is any future for these massive aviation companies if they haven't actually got an airfield, and that it's all going to be eventually sold for housing. So what are your thoughts about the 10th anniversary of the last flight of Concorde?
Well, Concorde was an iconic plane. Nothing quite as iconic as seeing a Concorde in the sky, especially flying towards Bristol. Of course, not that I knew much about it when Concorde was flying. I was living in Berkshire.
Did you ever actually see it? Because one of the things I remember, if Concorde was flying over, people would I mean, even grown adults would point up in the sky and say, it's Concord, as if there was only one.
I don't know. It's interesting because they very rarely came our way.
Didn't they? Didn't they make a racket as they took off from Heathrow and fly over Maidenhead?
Yes, they did, but we didn't get as many sort of coming westwards as they were going eastwards.
So it's more like you'd be sitting in the living room, quietly listening to the radio, watching TV or reading a book, and suddenly a crack would appear in the wall, yeah. And you say, oh, it's Concord.
No, our house is fairly sturdy. We didn't get a crack in the wall.
So, I mean, there was something quite special about it, wasn't there, in that it was the adaptation of military technology to peaceful civil use, and that I think was what made Concord something quite interesting and special. Also, it was a collaborative effort between the Brits and the French, although if you talk to people that worked on the programme, they would say that the French were quite reluctant, and the whole project was constantly under attack by the United States. The Americans were big American aviation companies were very, very against Concorde right from the start, and made all sorts of attempts right the way through till after it had been designed and finished to stop it actually even flying to the United States, which was obviously one of its most popular routes.
Why was that, Tony?
Why? Good question. Why did they? Is it just control freakery that they don't like the idea of other parts of the world? I mean, the British Empire was very much like that when we were an empire. We didn't want any of the technology that we had here in Britain for the Industrial Revolution, this kind of thing, being anywhere else in the world, and we do everything we could to stop it. And I wonder if maybe the Americans in the 1970s and 80s with Concorde were just exactly the same.
Yeah, well,
you reckon?
Well, so there's anyway, definitely an argument for it.
Anyway, will you be going up to see the Aeronautical Museum up at Filton when it opens, Jason, do you think?
Most certainly.
I mean, at the moment, if anyone wants to go and see the Bristol Aero Collection, I mean, we had a series of pieces on dialect about a year and a half ago about the Aero Collection. They are now based in a sort of temporary place up at Kemble Airfield, which is an interesting place in itself. That's up in Gloucestershire near Cirencester. It's about an hour's drive from Bristol if you want to go and visit it. And what I'll do is I'll just read out the opening times and dates at the end of the programme. But there is an old World War II hangar that you can go into up at Kemble, and you can see the Bristol Aero Collection. And actually, it's quite staggering the amount of stuff which was produced by the Bristol Aeroplane Company. But even just during World War II and after World War II, for example, helicopters, all sorts of aviation. And it was a Bristol Beaufighter, which was the very first Allied aeroplane to fly into German airspace in World War II. And by the end of the Second World War, Filton and the surrounding area was actually producing more aircraft than anywhere else on the planet at the end of World War II. Now, of course, producing nothing apart from some wings for Airbus. One thing I would say as well was that we had one of the campaigners from Save Bristol Airfield on BCFM about a year ago, maybe something like that, maybe a little bit less, before the airfield at Filton closed, explaining that when Airbus produced their annual report last year, Filton wasn't actually on the map of their operations anywhere in Europe, and there was a space where Airbus might have, I mean, they do have a plant up at Filton, obviously, but it wasn't on the map of operations produced by Airbus in France. So it does maybe,
oh, that's sad.
Maybe they've forgotten that there's a Filton operation, or maybe they're just planning to close it down. Who knows? Anyway, it's not a lot of fun for people working up there not to be sure about their futures. Anything more you want to say about Concorde? Did you ever want to fly on it? Did you ever see it?
I wanted to fly on it. I went inside on it. I wanted to fly on it. I never did fly on it because they never went to Greece.
Oh, right, okay. They went to Bahrain, I seem to remember. That was one of the places that they originally flew to.
Greece didn't like them.
So, brilliant bit of Bristol-based engineering. Fantastic that they managed to turn military technology into some civil purpose. Very kind of proud British project brought to its knees. Also, Richard Branson did offer to operate the plane, didn't he?
I don't recall that.
Yeah, for Virgin Airways. And
really?
Then they said no. BAE, I think it was either BAE or British Airways said no. And I think that was a very mean gesture, and personally would never fly on British Airways because of that sort of mean thing that they did, because they owned the planes. And they just said, no, we're not going to let Richard Branson not operate them. We would rather that they stopped and never moved again. And I think we've got some really mean people running aviation in this country. Anyway, what's the next scandal or news item we've got?
Well, it's actually not scandal such as MPs seek major reform in the wake of contract scandals. The powerful group of MPs, this particular, it says today in the thing, this one was...
That's in the eye, yeah.
Yeah, this... I don't have the date on it. It said, a powerful group of MPs will push top civil servants to agree on sweeping reforms of how government contracts run by private sector following failures at places like Serco and G4S.
That's funny, because I thought you were going to say that. Serco and G4S. I mean, these are some of the most important private contracts known to mankind, aren't they? Looking after prisons, people who've been incarcerated by the state. We've got this situation in the United States where most of these prisons are run by private prison companies, if not all of them. And you've even got deals being done, secret deals being done with judges, because the private prisons want more people in there because they get paid more, and judges have been caught at it and been sent to jail for putting people into jail when they don't really need to be, and they're getting bonuses from these private companies for jailing people.
Well, this should be a great worry to us then. This could be what happens in our justice system in the future. I mean, as far as there've been a lot of jail closures, I know the prison in Reading has just been shut. HMP Reading has just been shut.
And that is, was that a private one or was it a
state? That was a public one. It was the prison in which Oscar Wilde was incarcerated.
Reading, yes. And he wrote poetry from there, didn't he, in there?
Yeah.
Ballad of Reading Jail, is that right? Am I right about that?
Yeah.
And so what have Serco and G4S been up to deserve this special scrutiny by the Public Accounts Committee?
It's quite interesting. I'll read on a bit further before I get to answer that question. Margaret Hodge, the public accounts chairman, she wants to see all the financial information on government contracts revealed in what's known as open book accounting.
Well, so is she not allowed to know these things at the moment?
It says that they will be joined, and I mean, when I say they, this National Audit Office has full access to those contractual details, and they're going to be called before the Cabinet Office. They'll be joined by top Ministry of Defence civil servant, who could also be questioned over semi-privatisation of the £14 billion agency that buys tanks and guns. Here we are. It emerged in some of the 3,000 offenders they had charged for living abroad were in custody or dead.
Oh, dear. So they've basically been... this is fraud, isn't it? It's pretty simple. Yeah. I mean, what you do is you just send
G4S
off...
G4S admitted last week it overcharged the taxpayer by £24 million for tagging.
All right, so what they're saying is they're sending little bits of paper into the government saying we are looking after this number of people, this number of tags, and actually they just added a few numbers to the end of it when they hadn't really been looking after that number at all. And that is fraud. And you know, this really frustrates me that they don't seem to be talking about jailing people from G4S. I mean, maybe they wouldn't jail them in G4S jails. Or would you think they should tag them with G4S tags? Their directors.
It would be brilliantly ironic, isn't it? But that would mean they can't go anywhere near a G4S thing. Otherwise, the tag would go off. That'd be even better. So certainly it goes off if ever they approach a government contract.
I don't know if it's fair really to tag G4S directors and managers with their own tags. Maybe Serco tags should be put onto G4S.
G4S ones should be put onto Serco.
Yeah.
I like that.
this is how absurd our country's become, folks, under this coalition government. Next story, Jason.
Next story I think we're looking at is the Big Six. I mean, this is a cover story from the Eye today.
Hang on, don't say today, yeah, because it goes out. From the Eye, yeah.
So, Big Six. This was the cover story on Tuesday from the Eye. Big Six energy profits rocket again up to 75% in a year.
Okay, so this is 75% rise in profits. This is what they're making from every single consumer.
Yep.
Is up 75%.
Fuel giants earn 1.2 billion pounds from domestic gas bills in 2012. That's profit per household leaps from 30 to £53 in just 12 months and expect to double to £105 in 2013.
So it's 75% this year. They reckon next year it will be 100% rise. Now, look, I'm not getting 100% pay rise, Jason. I'm not sure about you. So how come these... I mean, it's just seems the entire country now is being run for rich taxpayers. Not taxpayers. In fact, they do pay a little bit of tax, but they're shareholders mainly, aren't they? People that are making money out of this. I mean, this is British Gas.
This is shocking, really.
The Big Six, let's just remind ourselves. The Big Six are, and there's this sort of fake idea of competition between them because they all sit down together and fix the prices in a cartel.
So the six are...
The six are British Gas,
N-Power, E.ON...
Scottish Power,
EDF,
and SSE. there, look at that. We got a little nice little double act there. So fuel giants earning £1.2 billion. This is so painful. Look,
if it was in
the public sector like it used to be in the good old days. Not everything was good in the good old days, but one of the things that was good is that you used to pay the cost price for energy. Now we're paying whatever that cost price is plus a massive slice, which is just going to the shareholders of these big six energy companies, and they're all in it together, aren't they? They are like the big society for the rich.
I mean, this is a real shocker for us here, Tony, is that rising, as for the rising profit margins go, it's 1.19 billion, that's 1.2 billion in 2012, compared to just 221 million in 2009.
Okay, so that's gone up massively. So do you think there's any prospect of people doing a mass I'm not going to pay my energy bills strike until somebody...
If the nation can organise.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, we used to have SWEB, didn't we? Southwest Electricity Board. Their job was to provide energy across the southwest of England at cost.
Well,
they did it.
We had Southern Electric in Berkshire, and as much as we used to get regular power outs in Maidenhead, they were at least affordable.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's providing at cost. This is the point. This is the point of nationalising something. And I go back to what I was saying earlier briefly about the idea of sort of we've gone from a post-World War II benevolent socialism, which I grew up in the 1960s and 70s, which was, you know, the sort of nanny state, that the state is there to be helpful. If you can't make it on your own for whatever reason, whether you're ill, whether you've been sacked or whatever, the state is there just to provide a backstop. Now the type of socialism we've got is actually verging on the authoritarian. I'm just looking at another story in that same edition.
I think we can call it socialism here.
Well, I mean, it's going towards the sort of national socialism, you know, like Hitler. It's really horrid. I mean, for example, Yvette Cooper this week in that same paper, you might just want to flick to it. She is the Labour Home Affairs spokesperson, and what she's doing is she's suggesting that all of the police areas in the country, I think there's 43 different ones, Avon and Somerset is just one of them, they're saying, well, basically the Police and Crime Commissioner experiment has failed. Well, hang on a minute, we haven't even had a chance to find out if it's working or not yet, but you've decided it's failed. And we're going to have to merge all these, and we keep hearing this. I mean, probably at least once a year there's a suggestion to do this. Normally it's from the extremely right-wing ACPO, which is a private company, the Association of Police Chief Police Officers, is a very authoritarian organisation, and they normally suggest this. They say, oh, well, we've got too many individual police areas. What they're now saying, or Yvette Cooper is now saying, is that, oh, no, we've got too many police, we should merge them all into one.
Yeah, it is shocking. I mean, one of the other people behind this, former Metropolitan Police Commissioner Lord Stevens of Kirk Welpington. What a name.
Welping?
Kirk Welpington.
Sounds like a puppy, doesn't he? But the actual idea, the suggestion, is from Yvette Cooper. This is 43 police forces should merge. and Yvette Cooper's going along with this. So, I mean, you know, this is, we're talking about a potential police state she's calling for here. I don't like it when socialists particularly get all authoritarian. It doesn't sit very well for me, particularly with the history in the 1930s of a very authoritarian state over in Nazi Germany, which was effectively National Socialism. You know, the idea was that, you know, this was going to be the other side of socialists. Socialists were, in the United States and in England, were coming up with all sorts of interesting ideas about how the state could be benevolent, whereas over there it became very authoritarian. Anyway, why is it, Jason, I'm just going to put this to you, why is it that the Labour Party are now coming up with policies which previous years were considered to be from the right wing, a far right wing? I mean, the ACPO is far right.
It's because of, I reckon, a lot of the media, especially privately owned media, is sort of gone very right wing. The country's gone very right wing, and Labour think the only way they can get elected is by going further right wing than the Conservatives.
So do you think it's just to sort of, you know, the idea is to get some positive press coverage and get votes that way?
Yeah.
It's pretty sad, isn't it? I mean, the fact of the matter is, of course, if you do merge all these police areas into one, then you have an immense possibility for police corruption. You know, this is the trouble. Essentially, is that if you've got it, if it's decentralised,
I mean, as if we haven't had enough police corruption recently.
Well, as if we haven't, no. And also, it doesn't look as if the people who've been involved in these various forms of corruption, you know, there are one or two, but most of them are still in their jobs. They don't actually even seem to get disciplined very much. Anyway, any final thoughts on why Yvette Cooper and the Labour Party have gone this swerve over, like, basically zigzag back on themselves?
I think I've said everything I need to say on that. I mean, I just think they're trying to capture the right-wing press.
Well, we'll see. And votes through the right-wing press. Playing to the gallery. Okay, now, we're going to deviate slightly from our news review, Jason. And this next clip is from a retired American general. His name is Wesley Clark. I know you're not shy of talking about things to do with the Middle East. And here he is talking back in September 2011. And what he's saying is that he came across a secret Pentagon plan, the idea being to take over 7 countries in 5 years. So let's have a listen to him. It's about a minute and a half, and then we'll get your comments, Jason, after that. 7 countries in 5 years. And here is General Wesley Clark.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, No. He says, "We've made the decision we're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq? Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, no. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran."
So go through the countries again?
Well, starting with Iraq, then Syria and Lebanon, then Libya, then Somalia and Sudan, and then back to Iran.
Well, watch out Sudan and watch out Somalia. Well, actually, no, Somalia, of course, is totally embroiled in a lot of this. Now, they've ticked off a few of those, haven't they, Jason? First of all, you know, do you think this is a credible report from this former general?
Well, I don't know. It's interesting, isn't it? It certainly seems to suggest that they planned this long in advance, and it certainly would go along with something I'd seen on the film Zeitgeist, where they were talking about, they're doing an interview with a friend of Nicholas Rockefeller, and he'd said to his friend who's being interviewed, "Well, let me tell you what's going to happen." and this was about June 2001, he said, first there's going to be a big event, and then we're going to invade Afghanistan, and then we're going to, after that we'll invade Iraq, and then we'll go into Venezuela and get rid of Chavez. So, you know.
Crikey, well, they certainly tried, and they got rid of Chavez, didn't they? But many people think by poisoning him and giving him cancer, rather nice of them. And a lot of South American leaders have been given cancer. So it does look as if, I mean, the most chilling comment in a way from Wesley Clark there is where he says, well, we've got a good military. We don't really know what to do, but we've got a good military and we can take out government.
Bomb everything.
I mean, this is no way to run a world, is it, America? Come on, guys. Mm. You know, how about looking after people in America itself before you start going bombing around the rest of the world?
Quite.
And the trouble, of course, is that we seem to go along with most everything the Americans say.
Yes, Mr. President. No, Mr. President.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back in a way to, you know, we were talking about Kemble Airfield earlier on. I know this might sound like a crazy connection, but Duncan Campbell's book, The Unsinkable Aircraft Carrier, he goes around the gazetteer. This is the investigative journalist from the 1980s, a gazetteer of a lot of US. He does a look at all of the American power in Britain, and one of the places he says that was used by the CIA in the 1980s was Kemble Airfield, just over in Gloucestershire. So they've got these massive customs warehouses up there, which were old World War II hangars converted into customs, like a bonded warehouse. So that all the stuff in there has just come in by plane, but it's not paid. No one's paid any customs duty. I wonder what's in those warehouses. If it's the CIA that's running planes backwards and forwards in the 1980s, I don't think they're doing that anymore. But it certainly makes you realise just how little we know about things which are so-called hidden behind official secrets and national secrecy and national security, this kind of thing. Anyway, after our little look at American foreign policy, let's have a bit of music from, and this is from a US group called Consolidated. The song's called America Number One, and interestingly, it's Consolidated appealing to the youth of Britain. This is from one of their John Peel sessions. Number one.
There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM, ITT, and ATT. DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide.
Started by the U.S. is a poor third world country. Just to divert attention away from the war they conduct against their own people every single day. Our politicians and entertainers continue to lie to us repeatedly.
Don't believe the hype.
There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT. And AT. Pumped down.
Well, they certainly don't hedge their bets. I urge you to try and track down their recordings, if you've not already done so, and give them a serious listen. That's Consolidated, the last from them tonight, obviously. America Number One is the title of it.
And that was John Peel. You can't really ask for much more of a commendation. That was the group Consolidated and the single America Number One. You think America is number one, Jason?
Probably not anymore.
I think there's some sort of like
probably China now.
Hypnosis, propaganda mantra that is beamed into all school children in America. America number one.
America is number one.
So anyway, I thought they did quite a good job with that. And as he says, track down their recordings. Anyway, on to another story. And one I've picked out here is actually from the local Bristol Post. It says Crown Court travellers guilty of laundering cash. Group of travellers laundered hundreds of thousands of pounds in complex criminal operation that spanned much of the UK. James Gilheeny, his wife Katrina and Mary O'Neill set up more than two dozen bank accounts between them. Police said yesterday up to £700,000 in cash was deposited to these accounts across England, Wales and even as far north as Kilmarnock in Scotland. Quite a lot of money going in and out of these various accounts. At Bristol Crown Court, James Gilheeny, 31, admitted converting £250,000 of criminal property between two. Basically, they're fencing, aren't they? It looks like between 2005 and 2012, and he was jailed for 2.5 years. So this was a looks like anyway, according to this Evening Post report by Daniel Evans, this was a place where stolen property was taken to be converted into cash. It's difficult to be so critical of this kind of operation when we know that HSBC, I noticed in the Huffington Post, is still doing money laundering itself, the bank, for Mexican
yes.
drug cartels.
That's it's shocking, really, you know, how the sort of big banks, they do this money laundering, doesn't get reported in the British press. However, anyone who might not be remotely British or like from a tribal community, look at them, criminals!
Well, also, of course, they're travellers. And, you know, I'm starting to think to myself, well, of course, they're looking particularly for itinerants, travellers, gypsies, these sort of people, to have a go at. And now, obviously, this is a criminal operation they're doing here. But why is it, do you think, that the travellers can get nicked by detectives from Avon and Somerset Police, but not the people at HSBC, like Lord Green, who's actually in the cabinet, and he's not nicked at all. He was chairman of HSBC while all this something like £6 billion of money laundering was going on, and it still is, according to the Huffington Post.
Well, quite simple there, Tony. The travellers can't defend themselves.
Well, they haven't got. Well, they can. They can surely. You can use some of this cash that they've got to pay for lawyers. I just. I think that, you know, there is a certain imbalance, isn't there? I mean, is there any chance, do you think, of getting the city fraudsters banged up or in jail? I mean, what? Why isn't it happening? Because everybody knows that they're committing fraud.
Well, because the political parties are afraid of annoying the super rich.
Why?
Well, that's a question, isn't it? I mean. They're afraid of annoying them because they have so much power. I mean, they could just move their business somewhere else. Or
is this globalisation?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Oh, gosh. Okay, so how's things in Greece recently? Have you been following the news over there at all in the last few weeks? Because they seem to be getting it in the neck. In fact, I look over at Greece and I think, you know, when there's another riot over there, I think, oh, well, it's going to be like that soon over here.
Well, let's hope not. Greece is not in a good position right now.
So what is actually happening over there? A lot of people losing their jobs, salaries going down. I mean, surely what this does, the effect of it, is simply to slow the economy down to virtually zero because people just don't have any money to spend.
That's the way it's going. They voted for a pro-austerity government and this is what they get.
What about your relatives over there? Because I know you're half Greek. What sort of reaction have they had to what's going on politically and in their own lives?
Well, my cousin Nick has still got a job at the moment. He works for an international computer software company. As for my cousin Annette, she lost her job, so she's very much in difficulty right now. But she was earning quite a bit, so she's still got a bit to go on.
The other thing is HSBC. I mean, you know, we do like to give the banksters a hard time on this show. HSBC are also involved in this foreign exchange fraud at the moment. So there are various banks involved in this, and there's international currency market investigations taking place. I mean, it seems that almost every financial crime that they can commit in the city, the big banks are doing it. And it's almost like, because banks like HSBC can get away with it, we've had lots of criticism, haven't we, of the Co-op Bank over the last few weeks. And they haven't been doing foreign exchange fraud, as far as we know. They haven't been doing money laundering, as far as we know. But they do have a chairman who has been, it looks like, allegedly anyway, buying drugs. I wonder if there's anybody in the city, in the some senior positions, who's never had cocaine, for example.
I think they all are. This is just a sting done by the Daily Mail, aimed at targeting somebody very close to the Labour Party.
Yeah, so that's this week. The UK's biggest bank, HSBC, reveals it's doubled the number of staff dealing with legal and regulatory issues to 4,700. Now, I don't know what those nearly 5,000 staff are doing, because they seem to be breaking almost every law and every rule in the book, HSBC. And in a way, the public have become, we have become sort of immune to this. It's almost like, well, we know they're money laundering for the Mexican drug cartels, but they're actually providing quite a good service for us as bank customers. And so we don't switch accounts, do we? Although if everybody had a moral conscience, of course, they could close HSBC down tomorrow.
Well, I don't know. Yes. I mean, it's shocking. I just generally don't think they know, really. I noticed it came from the Huffington Post, which isn't a UK paper. I don't think this is reported in the UK papers.
Okay. Also, the Mayor of Bristol, George Ferguson, on the telly this week, talking about residents' parking zones. What are your thoughts about the way this is going, residents' parking, Jason? Because the biggest criticism is that, though, this is just another tax. You know, why should I have to pay to park outside my own house, which I've been doing for the last 30, 40 years? And also that there is a sort of rush to do this in areas where actually there isn't really a problem with parking. It's just seems to be another way of the council raising money. Again, this sort of authoritarian brand of socialism.
Yeah, it is that, pretty much. You've really hit the nail on the head with that one, Tony. It's an authoritarian brand of socialism, and I think it's ridiculous, especially if there's no actual parking problems, then why are we trying to fix something that isn't broken?
Well, we saw on the TV programme on Channel 4 this week, a view of the control room of the CCTV system in Bristol, which is just, I think it's just down the road from around the back of the Full Moon at the bottom of Stokes Croft. And in sitting in there, these traffic people are looking at all the cameras and taking number plates, this sort of thing, of people who are parking up and down Gloucester Road. And there was a sort of farcical nature to it, that they were going gleefully taking people's numbers, even though it was quite clear on the cameras that, that these people weren't actually blocking buses or blocking cars, that the traffic was flowing freely past the cars. And I just get the impression that any way of imposing a tax or a fine on people is going to be taken. But anyway, I mean, we've got to do something, though, haven't we, surely, to get rid of congestion.
But, you know, how much congestion is there by people parking on the side of the road, Tony?
Well, quite a bit in the rush hour. It just depends where and when. I think that's the problem.
Well, maybe the alternative to RPZ then there is having sort of limited time parking.
All right. Okay, another little thing. I was a real treat for you now. I know you're a big David Icke fan.
Or not.
We've got a little clip now from a internet documentary called The Power Behind the New World Order. Oh, this is a documentary by Paul Flynn, who's an Irish guy, and he's put it up on the internet, The Power Behind the New World Order. But in it, he has a very interesting section, I think interesting anyway, which is 5 minutes long or so, which you're about to hear, which looks at David Icke and some of his influences. So let's have a listen to this extract and see what you make of it at the end of it.
Then came the third stage, which started in 2003, when I had an ayahuasca experience in Brazil, and a voice talked to me for 5 hours about the nature of reality. Real clear, very funny, and mind-blowing and life-changing.
I have often wondered if Icke has ever taken any precautions to make sure that the entities that he is in contact with are good entities. He often talks about how the Illuminati are in contact with bad extra-dimensional beings, after all.
And the same gods, demonic entities as they're called in this case, that are worshipped by the Satanists, are the same gods that are worshipped by the secret societies and the religions, unknowingly. In Satanism, it's knowingly.
These reptilian entities seem to operate, and again, it's not just reptilian. There are many different kinds of entities that do not have a human form, that operate just outside of human sight, and history has recorded them as demons and all this stuff.
So I wonder if he had a system to discern whether the ones that he's talking to are the same ones that are influencing the Illuminati. You can imagine I was a bit discouraged to hear things like this.
Well, I've been on a long journey of nearly 20 years now, consciously doing this, and some force has been pushing me in different directions through intuition, through urges. I've just got to do this, I've just got to go there. As I've gone through this and followed it, and who the force is and they are, I don't know. I'm not really that interested, funnily enough, because I just go with it and I'll remember what it's all about when I leave this genetic spacesuit.
Now, here is the mystery, considering all that we have learned so far.
I think there's a lot of this whole New Age area, you know, of Ascended Masters and all the Blavatsky stuff and Ashtar Command. I say that that is a belief system controlled by the same force, which is also trawling that energy as we go along.
Again, considering everything we've just learned, this is clearly an admission that he has been lied to by the spirits all of his life. I mean, if they told him that they were Alice Bailey's Ascended Masters, which they did, and they taught him theosophy word for word, which they did, he must be admitting here that all that he was taught is a lie. But the problem is that he has never stopped teaching and promoting the beings he talked to or what they told him to teach. He clearly attributes everything he is to them.
Among these messages that was given to me in 1990 were... he will say things and wonder where they came from. They will be our words. Sometimes we will put knowledge into his mind. Sometimes he will be led to knowledge. And another one was, a little bit later, arduous seeking is not necessary.
Ike never has mentioned the name Alice Bailey in his early books, although in them it's clear that he's teaching her doctrine, things like about the seven rays and the coming evolution, the solar logos, the new age, Atlantis, Lemuria, the age of Aquarius, being destroyed because of bad evolution, the earth spirit, the moon problem, her particular brand of reincarnation, even wearing certain colors. He never once, though, attributes any of it to her. He attributes it all to the spirits that he channeled. He says he got all this information from the spirit world, which I'm willing to believe. And therefore, I suppose it's possible that he hasn't made the connection that everything he believes is from Alice Bailey himself yet. He may have never noticed that what the spirits told him was word for word Alice Bailey and or Theosophy.
Alice Bailey was a disciple of the Luciferian Theosophist H.P. Blavatsky. She praised Blavatsky in the acknowledgement page of her work, A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, when she stated that the book was, quote, dedicated with gratitude to Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, that great disciple who lighted her in the East and brought the light to Europe and America in 1875, unquote. Alice Bailey never claimed to write any of her 24 books, but rather that the Tibetan spirit guide, Shual Kul, wrote them. In other words, Bailey was channeling the spirit.
Wow. What do you make of that, Jason?
He's an interesting fellow, isn't he?
Yeah, so, I mean, he's had ayahuasca for a start, which is a hallucinogenic, very powerful hallucinogenic drug. So he's seeing things, and he's connected up.
Spirits instructing him what to do.
So the big question here is, first of all, Alice Bailey, a lot of stuff David Icke is, it seems, has taken on from Alice Bailey without necessarily knowing. But the big question is this idea of being guided by voices? I find that a little bit worrying, the idea that you've got kind of voices in your head telling you things.
I mean, the question is, the question is, are these benevolent spirits or malevolent spirits?
Well, I don't know how he can discern between one or the other. It's really difficult to know. The other thing that he said, which kind of sticks in my mind there, was he's saying that the voices were telling him that arduous seeking is not necessary. Now, that means that this will all happen without him having to actually work too hard, and that the voices will just tell him everything he needs to know. A little bit worrying to think that that's the sort of modus operandi. And the thing is, Icke comes out with all sorts of fascinating stuff. And in fact, of course, he's absolutely right that the whole of the Western world is corrupt and run by a kind of secret government, but from behind the scenes, a lot of it anyway, certainly for many years. And that there are a lot of democratic decisions which are... I mean, we were talking, for example, about Scottish independence. This isn't something that the Scottish and English people have decided and agreed in a democratic way. It's just been decided by someone else that there's going to be this regionalisation of Europe, and this is going to happen. So there are some things to get positive from Icke, but if he's being guided by voices and he's not doing arduous seeking... Where is it all going?
Well, I have no idea. It's interesting. Obviously, he's visited at certain points by spirits. Although, from the sounds of it, it sounds as if his spirit might have a name, and it might be Alice Bailey.
The spirit of Alice Bailey. Anyway, definitely, Icke definitely needs to read a bit of that. The only thing is, I would say it positive about Icke is I think it's really good that there are people like him out there questioning things and, in a way, forcing people to think outside the box a bit, because we do seem to have a media and a government which is not asking some of the fundamental, basic and most important questions that need asking, such as why don't we have banks which serve the interests of the government even though the taxpayers own these banks? Fundamental things like that which just aren't being addressed.
Yeah, why aren't HSBC being
prosecuted? Yeah, another good example. Why is it that we are increasing the money to the royal family and then taking it away from some of the poorest and least able to look after themselves in society, like the poor and disabled?
Not quite.
Okay, well, we'll finish our rant now. But anyway, I thought you might find that quite interesting, the critique of David Icke.
And, that is certainly interesting.
Linking him up to Alice Bailey. Well, that's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. I've had a little look online at the Bristol Aero collection, and it looks like the main collection in Kemble was only open during the summers anyway, and so it's closed now, and I imagine we'll have to wait for the new aerospace exhibition at Filton to see it. Thanks to our studio guests today, just Jason Yannakopoulos and myself, and also, of course, a bit of David Icke, and also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. We're a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, contact Volunteering Bristol, 0117 989 7733. Thanks for listening, and I'm Tony Gosling. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now. It's better to be safe than sorry.